It's my privilege to introduce our next speaker, Professor Anthony Esselin, who is professor of English at Providence College and has served there for now just over 25 years, which is, it's hard to believe that that could be possible. But looking at the youth and energy of Dr. Esselin, so he's someone who's actually lived and experienced a very concrete and real instance of Dominicans in a university. So we thought it was especially appropriate for him to be a part of our symposium. He's also the editor of Touchstone Magazine and a frequent contributor to Magnificat. I'm sure many of you have read his spiritual reflections, often very insightful. He did his undergraduate at Princeton and then a master's and a PhD in Renaissance literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's well known to many of you, perhaps, as a translator of Dante, having translated the Divine Comedy, all three of those works. He's also translated Lucretius and Torquato Tasso, and he's an author in his own right and a prodigious one. In fact, his output is very impressive, and I can only say that it's staggering when you see the number of things that he writes and also the quality and the insight that he provides in writing them. But among the books that he's published, he has The Ironies of Faith, The Laughter at the Heart of Christian Literature, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Western Civilization, 10 Ways to Destroy the Imagination of Your Child. There's a famous YouTube clip of Dr. Esselin trying to explain that to some television news commentators who do not get it. Reclaiming Catholic Social Teaching, Reflections on the Christian Life, A Commentary on the Roman Missal. I myself had the great privilege of teaching for a year in the Western Civ program at Providence College with Dr. Esselin, which meant that it was part of my job to sit in the back of the room and listen to his lectures. There is no better job than that, actually. It was really wonderful, and it was a new education for me to listen to him lecture on not only Dante, but Shakespeare, the Passion plays, the Corpus Christi plays, Homer, you name it. A march through the great classics of the first millennium or so of Western civilization. And so it's our great privilege to have him here today to speak to us on Dante and the power of love in the intellectual life. Please welcome Dr. Anthony Esselin.
Thank you, Father. I think after that introduction, I should just go home now. And thank you all for coming here. The grace of God, as silent as the dew, immeasurable in its intimacy, as small and as great as the prompting of a human heart, grace of God changed the world on a certain day in Florence in the year 1274, probably sometime in April or May. That's what Dante says. And I'm going to take him at his word here, the literal word upon which is built his allegory of love. So what happened on that day? It must have been something political and ecclesiastical, and maybe in a certain strange sense it was both of those. Something that had to do with the city of man and the city of God. What was going on at that time? Plenty of things. Gregory X, busy reformer who tried to reconcile the conflicts in Italy between the loosely pro-papal Guelphs and the pro-imperial Ghibellines, but you must understand that Italian politics at the time had usually much less to do with ideas than it had to do with family ambitions. Just think of the mafia and you'll be all right. Gregory had summoned the Council of Lyon. He also had the problem of healing the rift between Italian cardinals and French cardinals that would come to a head in a few decades. The council opened that year on May the 7th. So was that what happened? The council opened. Gregory had even greater ends in mind than healing breaches in Italy and in Western Christendom. He hoped to heal the breach between the East and the West. The Emperor Michael Palaiologos was eager for assistance against the Turk, and he seemed ready to agree to theological terms. Thomas Aquinas, the great reconciler of powers of faith and reason, was supposed to be an important spokesman at the council, but he had died in March at Fossa Nuova, southern Italy. And his friend and teacher Albert of Cologne, en route to Lyon, learned about Thomas's death to his sadness. And Pope Gregory was collecting tithes for financing a fresh crusade. All of these things were going on, and yet it wasn't any of those things on that particular day that I'm interested in here today. It was something more momentous. A boy saw a girl. And this is what we are told about it. The boy Dante, born under the late spring sign of Gemini, was nearly 9 years old. So that puts the event sometime in April, May. One day he was walking down a street in Florence, which he never, by the way, names in this work, La Vita Nuova, where you hear about this encounter, when he saw for the first time a girl named Beatrice. Dante would later describe that meeting in La Vita Nuova, the work that would establish the terms for Western love poetry for the next 700 years. Not 800, unfortunately, but 700. Now, there had been love poetry before that in the Romance language-speaking world. Germanic love poetry before the Norman conquest, I don't know if it exists. We know that the Germans did make love. There's biological evidence for that. But anyway, the love poetry in the West had sprung up in full flower in the fields of Provence among the troubadours who celebrated the famous Phenom Or, courtly love, with a combination of zest, passion, irony, brilliant device, and sometimes absurd exaggeration that is so characteristically medieval and so far from the grubby grunting of the modern. So I think here of Lancelot, who liked to sing and dance a lot, a daft and dashing Lancelot in Chrétien de Troyes, the Knight of the Cart, crawling on his bare feet and bare hands and bare knees along a so-called sword bridge, which is turned edgewise over a rushing torrent, all to save Guinevere, his beloved, his bedmaid, the wife of his best friend, and his liege lord, King Arthur. So Dante was not any, imagine Lancelot cutting his flesh to ribbons while doing this. Dante was not the first to write of love. He was not even the first to cast a bemused and philosophical eye upon it. I think that Chrétien had already done that. That's more than 100 years before. He was, I think, the first to see in the pure love of a man for a woman an opening into the knowledge of the divine. This is the first to combine a powerful philosophical and theological mind and to train it upon that that meeting of members of the opposite sex, right? One or two others before him had pretended to be scholars of this love, but in La Vita Nuova, Dante was actually that, the first real poetic scholar of love, that kind of love. Of course, his expressions of love were not spontaneous effusions. Dante is not a modern confessional poet. He's medieval through and through. Whatever they did in grand and intricate systems. That's what we should expect from Dante. That's what we get in La Vita Nuova. It's an incredibly complex work. I'm not going to do it justice today. I couldn't possibly. You'd have to spend a whole semester studying only it. He's not a modern confessional poet, almost persuading himself that he actually had a human life somewhere. I think it's safe to say that no book before Dante's La Vita Nuova ever began with such consciousness that it was a book. These are its opening sentences. In that part of the book of my memory, before which there's little that can be read, there is a rubric saying, Incipit Vita Nova. Under that rubric, I find written many things, and among them the words which I intend to copy into this little book, if not all of them, at least their meaning, their sentencia, Italian. Let's pause for a moment to think about these words. For Dante, the memory was not just a recording device. In fact, sometimes in the Divine Comedy, the Italian word that he uses when he clearly is intending the memory is simply mente, mind. Latin memor suggests mindfulness, dwelling upon what has happened, making it present. You may think of the psalmist mindful of the ordinance of God as he lies at night upon his bed, or the wonderful liturgical phrase, unde et memores, whence we too, mindful, picking up on the command of the Lord in the institution of the sacrament, when you do this, be mindful of me. The memory we see is already a poet. It is even a liturgist. The book of Dante's memory suddenly presents us with a rubric. Now, rubric, before it became a word for bureaucratic chloroform, which is what it is now, all you people who teach in colleges or high schools know about this. We all have to follow rubrics. Before it was that, meant exactly what it suggests. It is an erubescent heading, a bold red heading. Think of red letters in a holy book, maybe the Missal, a book of prayer with its directions for how and when to pray the Holy Office. Or they may be the red letters on the first page of the Gospel, incipit. Evangelium secundum Matthaeum, incipit, typical word for a rubric of that sort. Here begins. Here begins. What begins? Incipit, and you would expect maybe something like Evangelium, okay? We read incipit vita nova. What does that mean? There are a couple of translators who simply render it as youth, as if we were reading a modern autobiography, My School Days at Rugby by Dante Alighieri. But it does mean youth, in part, and Dante's recovery on the mountain of purgatory will imply a return to youth, not the youth of his errors and confusion, but the exalted youth of a soul redeemed. For those that wait upon the Lord, as the prophet says, shall mount as on the wings of eagles. They shall run and not grow weary. They shall walk and not grow faint. Dante clearly has that in mind at the top of purgatory. I felt my feathers growing for the flight, he says, after he's been purged of the effects of every capital sin. And every one of the figures that he will then meet upon the mountaintop will be a beautiful young lady. But the phrase means youth in its fullness because it means the new life, or maybe the novel life, that is, the strange new life, a new life of wonder. Behold, says the one seated upon the throne in the Apocalypse of St. John, I make all things new. Here begins a life that is not like the life of the past. It is an elevated life, or at least it is a life that has the potential for elevation. It's on the way up. And here's the first recorded event of that new life, that strange life, that novel life. Here's the event that is its inception or conception. It's the event that shook the world. A boy meets a girl. Says Dante, and I'm going to cite his account of the event at some length and interject comments as I do this because of a rather long passage. Of course, this could never be modern. After three or four words, you know it could not have been written in the 20th century. It's too intellectual. Nine times already since my birth, the heaven of light returned almost to the same point in its revolution. Of course, if you're telling a story about yourself, you have to have a sextant or an astrolabe or something handy. When first the glorious lady of my mind... That's not the lady of my fiction-making powers. The lady of my mind was made manifest to my eyes. And that suggests a kind of epiphany. Even she who was called Beatrice by many who did not know her name. That's actually a bit of a crux there, how to translate what Dante actually says. I'll take him rather literally here, because it's humorous and very suggestive that people, when they saw this girl, called her Beatrice, even if they didn't know what her name was. She had already been in this life for so long that within her time, the heaven of the stars had moved eastward 1/12 of 1 degree. So that she appeared to me near the beginning of her 9th year. So she was what we would call 8 years old, right? It's her 9th year. And Dante is also 8 years old, and he's almost 9. I saw her near the end of my 9th year, right? She appeared to me robed in a most noble color, a humble and honest crimson is the typical translation. The Italian word is sanguigno, okay? And I think we're meant to hear the echo is very important, blood. Girdled and adorned as best suited her very young age. At that moment, I swear truly that the spirit of life, which dwells in the most secret chamber of the heart, began to tremble so violently that the least pulses of my body shook. And in trembling, it said these words, Ecce Deus fortior me, qui veniens dominabitur mihi. Behold, a God who is stronger than I, who in his coming shall be my master. At that moment, the spirit of the mind, which dwells in the lofty chamber to which all the senses carry their perceptions, the brain, was filled with wonder. And speaking more especially unto the spirit of vision, the eyesight, said these words, Apparuit jam beatitudo vestra, your bliss has appeared. At that moment, the natural spirit, which dwells where our nourishment is administered, began to weep. And in weeping said these words, Hoi miser, quia frequenter impeditus ero de inceps, wretch that I am, for from now on I shall often be thwarted. De inceps, it's kind of picking up, I think, an echo of incipit at the very beginning. It's funny when various faculties in you begin to speak Latin at you when you're 9 years old, or almost 9. So imagine this scene. Ward, says Mrs. Alighieri to her husband as he reads the political news. Ward, I think there's something wrong with Dante. Undoubtedly, there is something wrong with Dante if this life is to be a straightforward path of deepening ignorance and the satisfaction of lusts, if, in other words, this life is to be what a contemporary college education is all about, rather than about contemplation of the truth. But if we're called to love what is beautiful, and if where love is, there is an eye to see, ubi amor ibi oculus is the great phrase, from Richard of St. Victor, though I think I've just heard recently he picked that up from Augustine. If we're called to love what is beautiful, then what has happened to the boy is of great moment. Dante's words are too rich for me to pretend to reveal their full import, but let's take note of a few very odd things. I mean, the first is, the passage is bilingual. Why? Dante writes his poetry in Italian. So also his narrative in Levita Nuova. Levita Nuova alternates passages of prose and poetry. But the spirits of his own body and soul, even the spirit of his belly, they speak in Latin. The language of statesmanship in Cicero, of epic poetry in Virgil, the language of the schools and the schoolmen, and the language of sacred scripture and the liturgy. These are all one in Dante's mind. The spirits of the heart, the mind, and the belly are like members of a body politic or a body ecclesiastic, but one that is in a settled state of civil unrest. Now, that is no new thing for Italy or Christendom, but it seems new to the 9-year-old boy. The heart's declaration is perceptive, but ambivalent. The new God comes to be its dominus, the lord of the household. And it is not clear that the heart at first is entirely at ease about that. The mind, however, perceives the truth straight away and sends its message to the spirits of the eyes. Your bliss, and notice the present perfect tense, has appeared. Okay, not is going to appear or is in the process of appearing, but has already appeared. Everything, O vision, that by your created nature you wish to behold has made itself manifest to you. So the spirits of the mind are quite Thomistic in assigning a telos to the spirits of the eyes. And it is a beholding here, not merely a mental registering of color and light as on a photographic plate. Color and light may be the proper objects of the eyes as sensory organs, as Thomas says, but the proper objects of the eyes as organs of the intellect are beauty and truth. And these we do not simply see, we behold in wonder. That makes the cry of the belly a little less maudlin and a little more poignant. We might feel even a little bit sorry for the old belly. The belly will be impeditus from now on, literally tangled by the feet. This strange new life of love, whatever it may be, is as a spur to the mind, but a rein upon the belly. It aims to bring order to the little republic of Dante. The order is not simply or reductively rational. Rationalism, as we all know, is insane. Thomas Aquinas, that most rational of mystics, was once seen in midair, if we believe the account of his friend, and for a man of Thomas's size, that was no mean feat. We verge here upon what cannot be expressed in ordinary words, and that too is implied by the Latin, which is the language of the sacred. The Latin is heard not only in the cries that echo in Dante's being, but in the name of the beautiful girl herself. She is Beatrice, says Dante, but not in the way that she might have been Caterina or Teresa. When people meet her, they call her Beatrice, even if they do not know che si chiamare, says Dante, what she's called or what to call her. In other words, they become translators or prophets without knowing it. They translate what they behold in her into the name Beatrice, an Italian name, but an Italian name which is as close to Latin as it can be. Beatrice is the feminine for Beator. It is she who blesses. In naming her, and in naming her rightly, they exercise the prophetic privilege of Adam, who saw all the creatures that the Lord God made, and whatever he named them, peering into their being, those were to be their names. And here we can think of the medieval dictum, which Dante actually repeats at one point in La Vita Nuova, that nomina sunt consequentia rerum. Names are consequent upon the things that they name. This naming is a distant, but I think a sure echo of an earthly paradise that is not forever lost. It is removed to another place. Dante will figure it later in his career. It's removed to the mountain summit of Purgatory. That is where Dante will see Beatrice for the first time after her death, which at the time of Dante's writing La Vita Nuova had already occurred. And in fact, her death is an event inside this work. What happened after this brief encounter when Dante, the boy, was almost nine? He tells us that from then on, amore, signoreggiò l'anima mia, love lorded it over my soul, which was well disposed towards love, says Dante, because love was the center of his imaginative life. It was the life of his image-fashioning power. Hence, the boy tried to fulfill love's every pleasure. Now, here we move to the heart of the problems that Dante broaches in La Vita Nuova. We've got an odd mingling of things. What Dante has been given to behold. What Dante's imagination fashions. And love itself in its true reality. How do we make sense out of all this, after all? Love is not simply something that Dante beholds, as it were, at a distance in order to analyze it intellectually. It's something that he experiences profoundly within. It's incomprehensible from without, but also, in a certain sense, incomprehensible from within. Later in his career as a writer, Dante will say, trying to distinguish between love and love, that love is the seedbed of every virtuous deed and also the seedbed of every vicious deed. Something that we call love is the spur for everything that we do that is either good or evil. The boy Dante knows none of this at this time. He has to grapple with what he's been given now. Without love, there would be no vision of bliss, and without love, no fantastical objects of the imagination. And are those loves the same? What do they have to do with each other? It's the aim of this book to clarify what it means really to be a poet of love rather than a poet of imaginative desire. The word amore, like the thing itself, can cover a multitude of sins. So for 9 years, Dante Boy sought opportunities to catch sight of Beatrice, he tells us. All that seems innocuous enough until one day, at the ninth hour, right, he beholds her, dressed in the purest white and walking between two ladies who are elder than she is. At that moment, the ninth hour, she, per la sua ineffabile cortesia, by her ineffable courtesy, and ineffable is a theologically loaded word, right? Courtesy, her courtliness, her courtly love, la quale oggi meritata nel grande secolo, which today redounds to her merit in eternity, in the great revolution of the universe, mi salutò virtuosamente tanto, she saluted me, she greeted me. It's impossible to translate the word in English. It's got too many angles to it. She wished my health. She wished my salvation. With such virtue, that is to say, with such effectual power, che mi parve allora vedere tutti i termini della beatitudine. I seemed at that moment to see the utmost limits of bliss. So 9 years after he saw her the first time, and he's been trying to catch sight of her ever since, but when he's 18 years old, she says, hello, Dante. She wishes him his health, and it's over. Stagger, but not with strong drink, says the prophet. And that's what Dante does. He staggers home, not like my students at Providence College, or perhaps like them, come inebriato, as if inebriated, and he retires to his bedroom where he falls asleep and has a dream. The ninth hour. Dante insists upon the time. Think in terms of the hours of the office. This is, of course, the hour when Christ opened his heart for all the sinful world dying upon the cross. George Herbert's lines are most appropriate here. Love is that liquor, sweet and most divine, which my God feels as blood, but I as wine. Or when you think of the words of Psalm 23 in the Latin text, et calix meus inebrians, quam praeclaris est, and how excellent is my chalice that inebriates me. A rather different way of looking at that psalm than my cup runneth over. Dante's cup runneth over because his dream, highly symbolic, no doubt sent from heaven, is filtered through his still young mind and his fervid imagination, so that neither he nor we can be absolutely certain that the figures in this dream remain stable. It's highly symbolic and allegorical dream, but it is also a dream such as we human beings experience in our confusion. He sees a lordly figure, one that would strike the beholder with fear, yet this figure is filled with a wondrous joy. In his words, says Dante, reporting the dream to us, he said many things of which I understood but a little, among which I heard these words, ego dominus tuus, I am your Lord. That's very strange. Of course, he didn't have to do it that way. I mean, Dante could have just said, and I saw a figure. He was lordly and awe-inspiring, and he said, Ego Dominus Tuus. What he actually says is, he was speaking, and I didn't understand it. But I did catch this phrase, Ego Dominus Tuus. In a sense, we have three languages here. We have the Italian of the account of the event. We have this authoritative announcement in Latin. And we have a kind of ultra-Latin, a language beyond the capacity of Dante's intellect, perhaps a language even beyond language. It's very interesting, and precisely the same thing is going to happen to Dante the grown man in Paradiso when he meets the soul of his great-great-grandfather, Cacciaguida. O sanguis meus, the old, worthy old warrior will cry out in the only fully Latin tercet in the whole Divine Comedy, O blood of mine. But still his words, soaring high, must slope down, says Dante, like a falling arrow to strike his intellect. There's this Latin in the word. There's all kinds of words that Cacciaguida is saying that Dante says he can't catch, doesn't understand, doesn't recognize. The first thing that Dante really understands is this blessing in ordinary Italian. Benedetto sia tu, trino e uno, che nel mio seme sei tanto cortese. Blessed be you, three and one, you who have been so courteous to my seed. And Cacciaguida goes on for three cantos to be an instructor for his great-great-grandson, taking over for a while the role of Beatrice, teaching not about that part of Eros which is manifest in the love of a man for woman, but rather manifest in the civic passions of men. Ego Dominus Tuus, what does that mean? What were the words that Dante the youth could not understand? We see begin in La Vita Nuova what no created being can bring to conclusion, not Cacciaguida, not Beatrice. We see an instruction in love, by love, for the sake of love. Now, this is not to make a false god out of our appetites, otherwise the belly would have been pleased, not disgruntled. Love, such as we human beings imagine it, is not the Lord. It is the Lord who made heaven and earth who must be identified as love. As if we don't make a god out of our sentiments, out of our desires, but rather God identifies himself to us as love. It is God who is love. How can we poor human beings, though, circumscribed as we are by our creaturely being and bent by sin, how can we distinguish between what we know of love, what we mistake of love, and what love as a holy free gift wishes to reveal to us beyond even our natural capacities? The rest of Dante's dream gives us little help. This lordly figure is holding a woman nude but covered lightly in a blood-red cloth. Sanguigno is the precise color, again. I recognize, Dante says, la donna della salute, the phrase that resists translation. She is the lady, the domina, who gave him the greeting. The lady of the salutations is not, I saw the girl who said hi to me. It is the lady of the greeting, the lady of the salutation, the lady of salus, health in its broadest sense, with all of its theological echoes. Then the Lord says in Latin, vide cor tuum, behold your heart. He's holding that object in one hand. The heart is burning. Whereupon he wakes the lady and compels her to eat the heart, which she does, dubitosamente, wavering, uncertainly, at which this lordly fellow, lordly now no more, begins to weep loudly in bitter grief and rises with the lady out of sight. Dante wakes up. If you can make perfect sense out of that dream, then you should contact the Dante Society immediately. If you have had such a dream, you might take the advice of one of Dante's more ironical friends. When he heard about it, He advised Dante to have a doctor check his urine. But Dante wakes and translates the vision, as it were, into an ultra-Italian, into Italian poetry. It is Dante's way of revising his own youth as a poet, saying, "This here is the very first poem I ever wrote." Now, it's not the very first poem he ever wrote, but it's presented to us as the beginning, right? The beginning of his poetic career. He tells us then that he sent copies of the poem to several well-known trovatori of the day, finders, that is literally inventors, the finders of poetic or rhetorical devices for expressing the truths of the mind and heart. These poets were also, says Dante, fedeli d'amore, champions of love, faithful followers of love. So other love poets in Florence. The poem recounts the vision without adding anything of substance. Why is it important? Other than that Dante wrote it, the poem is meant to mark this young man's entry into a world of love poets, who are already little by little embarking on the educational quest that Dante would take up in full. That is, they are poets who are already attempting to see how far the love of man for a beautiful woman can take them in the search for the truth about the world and man's place in it. They are loitering in the precincts of the university. One of them, the greatest of Dante's predecessors, is Guido Cavalcanti, Dante's closest friend. Their friendship, Dante says, began from that moment when he sent the poems, copies of the poems, out to people. Because Guido replied to Dante by sending him a sonnet of his own, beginning with these words, "Vedesti al mio parere ogni valore." As it seems to me, you have beheld all of worth, all valor, all everything of worth. Cavalcanti and Dante were, as it turns out, the most prominent among a set of poets characterized by what Dante will call the dolce stil novo, that is the common term in Italian. If you go to Italian high school, you'll learn about the dolce stil novo, the sweet new style. And the poets are called the stil novisti. Sweet new style of love poetry. Now, there was, in Dante's Italy, there controversy about this sort of poetry. Their opponents found this poetry not sweet at all, but crabbed and burdened with matter taken from the schools. That stuff that you're doing with philosophy and theology doesn't really belong in love poetry because it requires a university degree to understand it. It's nonsense. And one of these poets, a fellow named Buonaggiunta of Lucca, satirized their preoccupation with philosophy and theology. Dante didn't like Buonaggiunta's poetry, but he would take his revenge out on him in a very sweet way. He puts Buonaggiunta in purgatory and has Buonaggiunta recognize him and cry out, "Hey!" But do I see the introducer of the new songs and those verses which begin, "Donne che avete intelletto d'amore," ladies who have intelligence of love, ladies who know by insight what love is, ladies who have an intuited or unmediated vision of love. And do I see that, man? Ladies who have intelligence of love. It's the opening line of the most brilliant poem in La Vita Nuova. Okay, so the enemy of all of this is made to say, "Hey, is that you?" That poem makes clear to the young and often self-absorbed poet that Beatrice is far more than the inducer of passions. She's a figure of Christ himself, desired in highest heaven. Anyone whom love suffers to stand and look upon Beatrice must either be made new, must become something noble, or must die. There is no third choice. And Dante replies to Buonaggiunta in words that seem to serve as a summation of all that he is as a thinker and as a poet. "Yeah, I am the introducer of those sweet new songs." This is what he says. "I mi son unche, quando amor mi spira, noto, e a quel modo che dita dentro, vo significando." I'm one who takes the pen when love breathes wisdom into me. and go finding the signs for what he speaks within. I am the notary of love, says Dante, as if his role were entirely passive, and I am the finder of signs for love, the highest calling for the most vigorous exercise of human art. Now, it is not an easy or an inevitable journey to go from being greeted by Beatrice when you're 18 years old to comprehending in one great poetic vision the union of divine love with all true and virtuous human love. To behold, as Dante's friend Guido put it so generously, everything of worth. It is a difficult journey, and I can't take you along the many byways of the journey here. I'll mention one or two. Early on in the work, La Vita Nuova, Dante happens at one point to be in church during a feast of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and he is staring at Beatrice, who's obviously further towards the sanctuary than he is, which is interesting. And directly in his line of sight is another woman, a beautiful young woman. And everybody who sees Dante gaping at Beatrice mistakes the matter and comes to the conclusion that he's actually gaping at the woman who is in between, okay? A kind of mediatrix here, but one who's entirely unconscious. And what she mediates is not love for Beatrice so much as Dante's desire to hide this love for Beatrice. It occurs to Dante that everybody has made this mistake, and he pursues it by pretending actually to be in love with this poor woman who happened merely to be sitting in the way, okay, called the screen lady. When this people call her the screen lady. When the screen lady early on in La Vita Nuova moves to another town, Dante is upset, not because he won't be seeing her, but because he's lost this fiction, and writes a poem in which he dares to compare his upset. Oh my gosh, now what am I going to do? There's nobody in the way between me and Beatrice. He actually uses language that comes from the Lamentations of Jeremiah. Oh, all you who pass by, behold and see, okay? That's very important, though. It's going to come back in La Vita Nuova. So it's a pilgrimage with many false starts and many wrong turns. The La Vita Nuova is not only the sorrows of young Dante; it's the glorious light of Beatrice shed upon Dante to raise his mind, which is sometimes a rather difficult task. To raise his mind to the mountains whence cometh his help, or to raise his mind to Christ, in whom and through whom all things that are have come to be. Come, let's be on our way, said Jesus to the apostles, and no one without fervent love will take one step along that arduous pilgrimage. That it is a pilgrimage is evident throughout La Vita Nuova. And I'm going to end here with two scenes, ones which I believe bear not only upon the education of young Dante, but also upon the very possibility of education, especially in our day. The first occurs very shortly before the death of Beatrice. Dante is sitting outdoors in a reverie. He does the reverie thing a lot in La Vita Nuova. That. Sorry. When his heart begins to tremble and love appears to him, urging him to bless the day he first took him captive. And indeed, says Dante, it seemed to me that my heart was so happy that it did not seem to be my heart. That it did not seem to be my heart per la sua nuova condizione, on account of its change, as we have in otherwise a very worthy translation here, new state of being, nuova condizione. Again, we have that word that rings throughout this work, nuova, young, strange, new. And just then, two ladies appear to him walking in his direction. The first is the beautiful woman to whom Dante's friend Guido had given his heart, though Dante suggests that it is not entirely clear that Guido has persevered in this love. Her name is Giovanna. But, quote, because of her beauty, as many believed, she had been given the name of Primavera, that is, springtime. Beatrice then follows a few steps behind the lady Primavera. Love then appears to Dante to give him a learned lecture upon the names of Guido's girlfriend. So we've already had discussion of Beatrice's name. We should notice first, though, as with Beatrice, so with Giovanna, the people who are struck with her beauty become sign finders, translators, prophets. Though she is Giovanna, they call her Primavera, spring, the first green. But the sign they find means more than they know. For love says that it is also Primavera. She shall come first. She shall be the forerunner, just as John the Baptist was for Christ, says love. And, after all, he notes, Giovanna is simply John, who preceded the true light, crying out in Latin, in maybe Latin with a Hebrew accent, Ego vox clamantis in deserto, parate viam domini. I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Prepare ye the way of the Lord. Anyone of subtle discernment, says love, would call Beatrice love because she so greatly resembles me. The allegorical ratio, I think, is clear here. Giovanna is to Beatrice as John is to Christ, who is love, who blesses his faithful ones. He is the Beator. And you should indeed bless the day when love, the Beator, takes you in his bonds. Giovanna is early springtime to the full flowering of the year. She is the preparatory walk, the preambulum to the pilgrimage of faith. Now, if our lives are a pilgrimage from love to love himself, from truth to truth himself, spurred on by our longing for beauty, then I suppose there are two ways we can fail in this pilgrimage. They may amount to the same thing in the end. We can go in the wrong direction, the errore, or wandering, that is a constant motif in Dante's comedy. Or we can despair of it all and simply refuse to move. Dante is in some danger of each of these after the death of Beatrice. And it may be that Guido Cavalcanti has succumbed to them, because Guido's poetry, though it prepared the way for Dante's poetry, as Giovanna prepares the way for Beatrice, Guido's poetry did not ultimately affirm the end, the vision of love in glory. Guido's father was a materialist heretic, according to Dante, so he puts him in the sixth circle of hell. And Guido himself, steeped in the philosophy of Averroes, seems to have concluded that that love is a grand and powerful thing. It is irresistible. There is no way we can, we lose all freedom of will in a confrontation with the power of love, and love is a destructive force, not this thing that lifts you up to glory. The state of Guido's soul died sometime in September of 1300, some months after Dante's date for his pilgrimage to the world beyond, is a somber motif throughout the whole Divine Comedy, and so too the status of Guido's poetry, that is another running motif through the Divine Comedy. Dante, too, could have taken that path, the path that Guido took. He had the brains for it, and he certainly had the inclinations of pride. You see already in La Vita Nuova that Dante is really doing a number on his friend Guido, because in essence he's suggesting that his own poetry is to Guido's poetry, as the preaching of Christ is to the preaching of John the Baptist. But a breakthrough of the grace of God occurs near the end of La Vita Nuova. Dante has been in danger of forgetting Beatrice and attaching his affection to another lady. When he dreams of Beatrice in glory, again draped in a blood-red robe, it's sanguigno once again, and he's filled with remorse. After this period of distress, he says, during the season when many people go to see the blessed image that Jesus Christ left us as a visible sign of his most beautiful countenance, which my lady beholds in glory, it happened that some pilgrims were going down a street which runs through the center of the city, where the most gracious lady was born, lived, and died. Okay? He had addressed people earlier in Levitin Vobis with the words of Jeremiah saying, hey, come on over here and see if any grief has ever been as great as mine. I lost the lady that everybody thought that I loved, and now I don't know what to do to pull the wool over their eyes. This time they are really pilgrims going to see the image of Christ on the Veronica, the face of Christ. The pilgrims are deep in thought, and Dante, somewhat incongruously, wonders, hey, what do they know that Beatrice lived in this city? Maybe the pilgrims don't really know what they are about. In other words, he thinks he has something to teach the pilgrims. Actually, the pilgrims do know what they are about. It's Lent. They've traveled from afar to behold the face of Christ, whom Beatrice beholds and whom Beatrice resembles. They are on the way towards Beatrice, and Dante here is not. But that changes almost at once. Dante's last sonnet in La Vita Nuova describes his own spirit as a pilgrim, journeying far from home, beyond the realm of the fixed stars themselves, for intelligenza nova, che l'amore piangendo mette in lui, pur su lo tira. A new intelligence is the nova again, with all of its meanings, a new intelligence which love in tears has placed within it, urges it, Dante's spirit, urges his spirit to rise. In that realm, he is as dazzled as is a man who tries to behold the sun. The earthly intellect cannot comprehend the abundant brilliance of heaven. But still this nova intelligenza spurs him on and brings him a final vision. About this vision, we are told nothing specific. There is no lordly man. There is no lady in a red robe. There is no burning heart to eat. It is beyond his poetic capacity, so he resolves, quote, to say no more about this blessed one, questa benedetta, until I would be capable of writing about her in a nobler way. I don't have the ultra Italian yet to do justice to her. He seems already to have in mind the great pilgrimage of the comedy. I hope to write of her, he says, that which has never been written of any other woman, which is actually true. And he did just that. And then he says, ending his work, may it please the one who is the Lord of graciousness that my soul ascend to behold the glory of its lady, that is, of that blessed Beatrice, who in glory contemplates the countenance of the one qui est per omnia saecula benedictus, who is for all ages blessed. So we seem to hear the intent to write the greatest poem ever written. The whole enterprise now seems impossible. I said that the event on that street in Florence, that is nowadays, seems impossible. The event on the street in Florence when boy met girl changed the world, gave us the Divine Comedy. From that time until almost our time, Western man did not think it odd to suppose that the love of a beautiful and virtuous woman could be the beginning of an intellectual and spiritual journey leading to redemption, the new life, and glory. It's there in Shakespeare's Winter's Tale, when a one-time tyrant and jealous husband, Leontes, after 16 years of penance, beholds his wife and daughter again, both of them believed dead, and the wife, Hermione, appearing to come to life from stone itself. It's there in Spenser, in Red Cross Knight's devotion to Una and her devotion to him. It's there in Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the Blessed Damozel, in Robert Browning, all over the place. It's the figure of Pompilia, the virtuous young woman in The Ring and the Book. It's there by way of absence in T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men, the half-men, men of straw who fear to look upon the eyes of a mysterious blessed woman. It animates our art no longer, and I do not believe it is a coincidence that the quest for the good and the true and the beautiful no longer animates our education. My poor students are not half-wits. They were born with brains enough. They're half-hearts. What C.S. Lewis warned us about in The Abolition of Man has continued unabated and is worse than what he foresaw, I think. He still believed that a schoolboy could be surprised by joy, as he was, when he read the noble tale of Balder the Good. He had no idea that Balder would be discarded and replaced with vampires and prostitutes. He still thought that sexual love in youth would go wrong in the old-fashioned ways. by still passionate fornication. He knew that the pursuit of Eros in the wrong way would kill Eros first of all, but I don't know if he imagined a world as immersed in pornography as ours is, as careless of the sexual sins and as bored with it all. Loveless, a world without kisses, even if they are kisses of the wrong sort. My students are not in love. They tell us so. They don't want to be. An education in love, which is what Dante and the great Christian poets provide for us, is food for the journey, for a pilgrimage, in which you risk losing all to gain the end at last. If the vision of love himself is the end, all other considerations pale in significance, considerations of money or ambition or prestige. But if money and ambition and prestige are what you are all about, then love must be rejected. Love gets in the way of ambition. Love of Christ certainly does, even the love of a beautiful young person. Love rides into the great wilderness, but we want our plans instead. Love opens a wound in the mind and the heart. We want a callus. Love cannot be cashed in at the bank. Love does not appear in a resume. The concrete and glass facades of our economic temples are not the work of men in love. The bricks of our universities are not set in place by men in love. Our statesmen do not love their country, and some of our priests do not love their church. So what should we do about it? We can teach our students what Aquinas has to say about love. And indeed, if Aquinas were not a man in love, he would never have been so raised beyond himself as to dictate four books to four secretaries as he walked about his cell. We must teach our students how to love goodness, beauty, truth. That is not easy. Everything is against us. The popular anti-culture, the structure of the university, the dead hand of 12 years of school without poetry, without faith, without even a natural love of country and gratitude towards one's forebears. All these are against us, and the sexual revolution lies like lead within our bosoms. But we are made to delight in beauty. It's all in Plato, Lewis's professor says with a sigh. It's all there. Did Dante actually meet Beatrice in exactly the fashion he describes at exactly the moment? I don't know. You must distrust the medieval drive to order. I believe he had an experience of beauty embodied in Beatrice that changed his life forever. It's a measure of our own depletion that such a thing is beyond our imagining. And if in our schools there's no place for the love that beauty inspires, then it would be better for the souls of our young people if they had never heard of that place. Thus would Dante have more to say to an illiterate plowboy than to an inmate of our schools, because the plowboy would still enjoy that liberty of the soul that is made for love. The education of the affections must precede critical thinking, or the latter will degenerate into sophistry and cynicism. That, too, is in Lewis and Plato and all the poets. That, I think, is the educational task before us. And let us see to it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
And it's one turn. We have time just for a few questions. Yeah.
Would you recommend somebody who hasn't read or hasn't reread the Divine Comedy and La Vita or which comes first?
I think that the easiest thing to do would be to read the Divine Comedy first, in a good translation, which I can recommend. It's incomparably the greater work and more complex, more intricate, but it is also more accessible. The La Vita Nuova, you will be tempted to read it as just a rehashing of various things that happened to him into his youth and the poems that he wrote. I find it extraordinarily subtle. It's something that you would have to wrestle with over many years. Wrestling with the Divine Comedy is not exactly the gerund that I would use in that regard. They're both, of course, great riches, right? I mean, you can read them 50 times and still be saying, why did I not see that at first? But I think that we have a way towards understanding at least the basic idea of the Divine Comedy, that journey to the three realms of the other world than La Vita Nuova. La Vita Nuova is in ways more foreign to us, although it became the standard inspiration for books of love poetry for, you know, centuries. But I would go to it second. And this is a pretty good edition. This is Mark Muse's edition of La Vita Nuova. He doesn't give the Italian in the prose sections, but the poetry is given in both Italian and in his workmanlike but very accurate and not unpleasant English verse. And his essays in the back of this are profound and very perceptive. So I would go to this edition of La Vita Nuova, but I would read the Divine Comedy first. There's a question over there.
Talk about the education of the affection.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
With my children and, you know, in education in general, searching for that. How, you know, that's probably another lecture, but any things to go to or?
Yeah, I think that, are you homeschooler?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the fact that you're worried about it suggests that you probably don't have to worry as much as you are. Your allies in this regard are good and great works of literature and art and music. They're all your allies. And the natural world is your ally. Okay, that thing that our students know less and less about. It's almost you don't have to make a concerted effort if your kids are removed from the most toxic poisons. But I think you would be fooling yourself if you believed that a good homeschooling curriculum and plenty of time outdoors would be sufficient guard against the toxins that come from the internet. I think you have to keep a very close eye upon that, or maybe limit the time to a few hours a week, if any at all. There's not really much that goes on there that's of any value to a child.
Or would you say the same for even a university student?
Yeah, definitely a university student. We were talking about this last night. This year, my two-hour-long seminars, I've been giving my students a break so they can go to the bathroom or something in between, for a few minutes. And why I still don't know what they're going to do with that, I don't know. I expected that they would talk to each other if they didn't go to the bathroom or go to get a drink. But they don't talk to each other. They get the phones out. And so you have these, you know, these really good-looking young women and really good-looking young men, and they're right next to each other. And we've been having fun talking about something for an hour and laughing and all that. And then when I give them time to take it easy, dead silence falls upon the room. And no flirtation or anything like that. And as an Italian, I mean, I just find this it's inhuman.
On that question, is there a priority in teaching beauty, truth, or goodness? Does one come before the other?
Yeah, I think that if we're talking about a temporal priority, that is in the raising of children, I think that Lewis has got it in The Abolition of Man. You train the affections first, and their beauty and goodness are mingled. You train someone up to say, wow, that is a beautiful and noble deed. I want to be like that. Or what a beautiful mountain that is, okay? That mountain ought to be appreciated. That mountain is sublime, okay? I think that that's primary. Eventually, the young people will be fit for disputations, for dialectic, for what is strangely called critical thinking. And if somebody can explain to me what the difference is supposed to be between thinking and critical thinking, I would like to know what that is. I suspect that in schools, critical thinking is largely a project of of reduction and cynicism. It's not aimed at the truth. It's aimed at cultivating a kind of suspicion that there is anything true at all. And it's dead. That's deadly. That I see in my students. My students, unless I repeat to them all the time, my students will default to the position that if they're writing about a paper about any moral issue, they cannot really say anything about it definitively. They have to say, well, of course, because this is a moral issue, it's really subjective and it's everybody's opinion. And I want to answer, but I don't because I'm too nice as I've gotten older. I want to answer, well, obviously I'm not trusting you with my car keys. Or please don't show up in my office with a swastika. I'll know what that's all about. I think you've got to go for the affections first and ignore all the educationist nonsense that focuses for children on critical thinking. I think that's crazy.
Let's give our thanks to Dr. Esselin for the time.